MacCast, Monday, March 12th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I hope you are having as good a day as my neighbors must be having. There's a, you probably won't be able to hear it on the recording, but there is a party going on outside. It's Monday night. I don't know what's going on, but I've got music bumping in here into the studio, and it's just that's a very interesting thing. It's strange for where I live. Doesn't happen too often, but we're gonna power through it. This is podcasting after all, right? You never know what to expect. Been a little while since we chatted. I apologize for that. It's just been crazy busy around here, and a lot obviously has been happening. Last week, Apple announced the new iPad and everything that goes along with that, and you probably know a lot of the little specs and details. Maybe you even ordered yours already, but what I like to do when these events happen is rather than just rush information out, because there is so much information, I try and break through that kind of reality distortion field that happens and really drill down and get, you know, some answers to some hard questions, because I wonder about the tech stuff. I know you do. I want to know about details. I want to know about how things work, about the new software updates, any bugs, any issues that we might have when upgrading. So we're going to talk about all of that stuff in today's episode, along with a whole lot more, of course. But before we dive into that, let's take a moment and recognize one of our show sponsors, and that's Gazelle. Actually, Gazelle is a good company to know about right now, because if you are considering getting a new iPad, you may want to be, you know, getting rid of your old one. You might want to sell it, get some cash for that, and Gazelle is a great way to do that. As a matter of fact, I did that with my original iPads to kind of help fund my iPad 2. So I'm getting some cash back on those. I'm going to be sending them to Gazelle. I've got them all boxed up here, as a matter of fact. And they make it really easy, and they just streamlined the whole process. So they're taking less items now, but it's much more consolidated, a much easier experience when you go on the website. So check out the new website, gazelle.com, and they make it just so simple. You go there, you'll see the iPads listed right there. You say, hey, I've got an iPad that I want to sell. You'll answer some basic questions, which model, what kind of storage, what kind of condition is it in? And once you've done that, it will pop right up there on the screen with an offer. They'll say, hey, we'll give you this much for it. And they are a re-commerce site. So what happens is they'll take your product in and they'll even send you a shipping label. So once you've gone through the whole process, they'll send you an email. They'll give you all the instructions. They'll tell you how to print out your shipping label to send it in, tell you what to do. In some cases, they'll even provide a box. But you package it all up, you send it in, and then once they receive it, what they'll do is they'll inspect it, they'll check and make sure that it matches the condition and has all the accessories that you said it did. If that is the case, then they will send you your money, and you can get it via PayPal, Amazon gift card. There's a bunch of different ways that you can receive payment. You can even have the value of your item donated to charity, so if you'd rather just give back. But as I was saying, they're a re-commerce service, so then what they do, so they take it in, they wipe it, they get all of the private data off it, and they get it ready, and then they put it back out into the marketplace. So it's not going to end up in a landfill. They're actually going to put it into reuse. They're going to resell it and get it back out in the market to somebody who can use it and benefit from it. So it's kind of a great thing all around. You don't have to deal with the hassles of auction sites and selling it yourself, and you should really check it out. You can get more information and details at gazelle.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So let's talk about the new iPad. Are you as excited about it as I am? You know, a lot of the specs that we were hearing about before the announcement turned out to be true. You know, overall, my impression after the event happened was this is really an evolutionary update, not revolutionary, much in the same way that the iPad 1 to 2 update happened. But I have to say, I think this is even more significant in terms of just the feature set and the improvements to the iPad than the transition from the 1 to the 2. So if you're still on a 1 and been thinking about an upgrade, I think this would be a really great upgrade. The screen is the biggest deal. It is the Retina display, what Apple's calling the Retina display, 2048 by 1536 pixels. The panel is reportedly being made by Samsung, Sharp, and LG. They're all in on the action this time around. And it uses what is called an, I don't know if you say this, AC or ASI. It's A-SI-TFT technology. It's still at 9.7-inch panel, but the pixel density is the big thing here. It has 264 pixels per inch, and that reportedly is really pushing the limits of this technology. Apple went into some of the details. Actually, Phil Schiller went into some of the details in the keynote event, which is up on Apple's website. If you want to catch the video, you can get it there. Also, they have that available as a podcast. I don't know if you know that. There's a keynote podcast, and you can get that through iTunes, but you can watch it. And basically, they had to do some things to actually get this to look as good as it's going to look. And I'll tell you how good it looks on Friday, because I got my order in. But it's they have to use double the LEDs for the backlighting. They also use something called a super high aperture pixel design. And what it amounts to is they have to separate the pixels, the actual pixels on the panel itself, from the signal lines that are carrying, you know, which pixels to turn on and off, that information. Because I guess when the pixels are packed that tightly, there's a lot of noise that can occur and that can impact the image. So all of the manufacturers have said that this panel has been particularly difficult to put together. So I imagine that's going to lead to some supply constraints. But probably to Apple's benefit, it also means that their competitors are going to have a really hard time matching this pixel density anytime soon, especially if Apple's tied up Samsung, Sharp, and LG, the three biggest panel manufacturers out there. So it'll be interesting to see if anybody can come up with a Retina display anytime soon, but I don't think they will. I think it's going to be exclusive on the iPad for a while. So that's the display. The processor, Apple did end up releasing a dual-core A5X, so we didn't see the A6 quad-core this time around, but the chip does have quad-core graphics, so much more focus on the graphics side of things. And I think, again, that's because they're needing to drive that new display, that really high resolution. There's going to be a lot of image processing that needs to go on in that chipset, so they've highly optimized this one for that. Apple claimed in their keynote that it outperforms the NVIDIA Tegra 3, but they didn't really provide any benchmarks to back it up. I noticed on the slide they didn't have the little, sometimes they'll have a little footnote saying, hey, here's the tests we ran, here's where we got these specs from, but they just kind of threw that out there. NVIDIA is saying, hey, we're not sure about that. We'll run our own benchmarks and compare it. And I'm sure we'll get some real-world speed tests comparing the two in the future. But Apple's claiming it's better than the NVIDIA Tegra 3 processor. So that's the processor. Then the camera, there's a lot of speculation leading up to the event. Is it going to be 5 megapixel, 8 megapixel? And a couple of interesting things happened with the camera. So it turned out to be a 5-megapixel EyeSight camera. And the EyeSight is significant because it sounds like Apple is changing the terminology of cameras. And I'm hoping they're going to do this across the board because I think it's going to make discussing these things. I never know where to say, oh, it's the front side camera, it's the back side camera, and I get them all confused and stuff like that. Sounds like the distinction now with the new iPad is that the EyeSight camera is the one that's going to be like your eye. It's going to be the things that you are looking at. So looking out at. So that's the back-facing. See, I don't know what to call it. Back-facing camera, I think is what it is. Basically the one that you're going to shoot stuff with. You're going to shoot video with it. You're going to take your pictures with it. That is now called the EyeSight camera. And that's a little bit confusing because in our Macs and everything for the longest time, the camera that we used for doing chat and iChat and FaceTime was the EyeSight camera. That's now the FaceTime camera. So same thing on the iOS devices. FaceTime camera for doing FaceTime and chat, the camera that's looking at you. EyeSight camera is the camera you're going to use for taking pictures and stuff like that. So I thought that was great and makes the distinction a lot easier, and I'm going to use that terminology moving forward. But the EyeSight camera is a 5-megapixel sensor, so that did get a bump up, but it's not up to the 8 megapixels that we have in the iPhone 4S. The FaceTime camera remains the same. It's a VGA camera, and that's basically the same specifications as the iPhone 4. So with those two cameras, you're up to iPhone 4 levels on the new iPad in terms of the cameras, with one distinction, and that is that the lens system that is in the EyeSight camera on the new iPad is the same 5-lens system that is in the iPhone 4S. So that's the 2.4 aperture 5-element lens system. So that should really help. You know, Apple has often said it's not all just about the megapixels, it's the other technologies that's in there. And I really think that is the case when you look at the actual images. So backside illuminated sensor does face detection, can automatically balance and focus your exposure up to 10 faces. It recognizes more people now in the face detection, I think because of some of the processing power, and it has the hybrid infrared filter. So the pictures coming off this thing, I think, are going to look great. The other thing that the new lens brings is that you now have, well, the new lens and all the graphics processing, is you now have full support for 1080p HD video, both in terms of recording and playback, and that includes automatic video stabilization, which is always turned on. So you're always going to be able to kind of handhold it and get some really nice stabilized video. So I think everybody was very excited to see the cameras in the iPad finally making their way up to something that I think is very acceptable. Once again, I really don't think this is going to be a camera that a lot of people are going to use a lot of the time. But in a pinch, if you need to take some video and that's the device you have with you, it's going to be a great camera to take that with, to take some snapshots. I still don't see people being out and about holding up their iPads, but maybe this changes it. Maybe now that we have decent cameras in there, that becomes a whole new thing. It'll be interesting to see people completely shooting, editing, and creating probably like movies on iPads exclusively. Because with 1080p video, you can probably get some amazing quality if you do it right. So it's going to be really fun to see what people do with the new camera system. Another thing that a lot of people were wondering about was, is Siri going to make her appearance finally on the iPad? And unfortunately, the answer turned out to be no, at least not Siri as we know her on the iPhone 4S. What we are going to get is voice dictation, which I think is going to be a nice addition. You know, the iPad has really made inroads into the enterprise and into education and stuff like that. And I think for those applications, having voice dictation is going to be very, very popular. And just even, I can even imagine myself here in my office, if I want to compose off a quick email or something like that, just reach over and use the voice dictation feature on the iPad. I haven't played around with that too much on my iPhone 4S, but that's mainly because I'm out and about when I'm using my iPhone, so I'm not always in the most quiet environment. You feel a little awkward, you know, dictating a letter or something into your phone. But I could see that doing that around the house on the iPad. So that's going to be fun to play around with. It did come in just slightly thicker and weighing a little bit more. We had not heard that it was actually going to weigh more, but I guess it makes sense that if it's going to get thicker and they're going to have to cram more stuff in there, the weight might go up. But really, it's just 0.03 inches thicker and weighs just 0.13 pounds more than the iPad 2. It does sound like the back panel is a little bit more tapered. I was having a hard time finding confirmation on this, but I looked at some pictures from The Verge, and I tried to compare them very closely to my iPad, and it does seem like there is a slight difference on that. And that little bit of thickness plus that tapered edge is going to affect some cases. I don't think it's really going to impact any accessories. But if you have one of those really form-fitting, hard plastic shell-style cases, that might, you know, for your iPad 2, that might not work with the new iPad. But I think all kinds of other cases, the silicone cases, the skins and things like that, for the most part, are going to work. And Apple's Smart Cover is exactly the same. So if you have a Smart Cover or you want to order a Smart Cover with your new iPad, that should go on there no problem. Got the same magnet system, same magnet on-off switch and all that sort of stuff. We have no official word in terms of specs on the RAM. A lot of speculation flying around. I would say it's likely that it's going to be at least the same 512 megabytes that's currently in the iPad 2. The Verge did report that they had confirmation that it was going to be 1 gigabyte. That would be nice to see and would go along with just, you know, up to specs, a sort of evolutionary spec upgrade across the board. And I think that'll help too, in terms of having some extra RAM for the memory and some of the video processing and things like that. So we'll have to wait for like iFixit to do their teardown, and I'm sure they're going to do that first thing when they get it in their hands on Friday. So probably by Friday evening, we'll know how much RAM is officially in the iPad. But Apple doesn't state that specification on their website, which is, I don't know why they don't. I think they should tout that sort of thing. Battery life, you might be wondering, with all this extra power, the bigger graphics, you know, bigger display, are you going to get less battery life? And Apple managed to get the same amount of battery life in there, 10 hours, they claim. You know, real-world usage is obviously going to vary from that, but I would imagine you're going to be able to go pretty much a whole day actually probably several days, which is what I get out of my iPad in normal usage. I don't plug it in all that often, which is just amazing to me. And they do have 4G. We'll talk about that in a minute. But if you're using the 4G technology, they claim 9 hours on the battery life. And why is that? You might be wondering. Well, ZDNet had some notes on the battery. Just looking at the tech specs, they noted that it went from a 25 watt hour in the iPad 2 to a 42 watt hour in the new iPad, so almost double the watt hours. And they point out that if you convert that into milliamps, the battery goes from 6,900 in 44 milliamps to 11,666 milliamp hours in terms of the battery. That is just amazing, considering that the size of the device didn't increase all that much. So the speculation is that there's some serious new battery technology going in there to get those batteries to produce that much energy and still maintain the kind of same space requirements. Now, I think we did see early on that the main board for the iPad is probably a little bit smaller. So I have a feeling when iFixit does that teardown, you're going to open it up, it's going to be all battery inside that case and probably not much else. Just cramming in the sensors and the memory and all that sort of stuff kind of off to the side and just making it fit in there. So that is just really cool. And the good news on that is that if Apple really has developed some new battery technology in there, that could make its way into the next generation iPhone, which is probably going to be in the fall, the iPhone 5, and that will allow Apple to bring 4G technology and some of these, you know, bigger processors, something like a quad-core A6 potentially to the iPhone and solve some of the energy issues. Another way Apple is solving some of the energy issues is the new iPhone does support Bluetooth 4.0, which has lower energy requirements and also offers better range. So you're going to be able to have Bluetooth devices that use less battery, that are smaller. We're starting to see some of these pressure-sensitive styluses come out that use Bluetooth technologies. And in talking to some of the developers at Macworld this year, they were very excited about Bluetooth 4.0 because that'll allow them to keep their pen sizes, their stylus sizes down, and still get pretty good battery life and Bluetooth reception through those systems. So with next generation Bluetooth being in there, we're going to see some great Bluetooth accessories coming out, I think. And then 4G. 4G LTE support, Apple's first product to support 4G. Apple announced they're going to support it in the U.S. and Canada on AT&T, Verizon in the U.S., Bell, Rogers, and Telus in Canada. Engadget reported this week also that Best Buy's internal systems supposedly show a Sprint version maybe on the way. I don't know if it'll be there for launch, but we can hope. And then in Canada, Virgin Mobile is also reported to be potentially carrying the new iPad. But both those, Sprint in the U.S. and Virgin Mobile in Canada, those are both rumors. Some things that came out with respect to the carriers in the U.S., Verizon is going to include Wi-Fi hotspot in all of their iPad data plans. So if you get the Verizon version, you're able to use that as a Wi-Fi hotspot, and that's included in the price of your data plan. AT&T, on the other hand, said they won't offer even the ability to use your device as a Wi-Fi hotspot, your iPad as a Wi-Fi hotspot at launch. They said they're thinking about it. Yeah, right, okay. And they're not even going to offer it for a fee, so you can't even pay to use it as a Wi-Fi hotspot, at least at launch on AT&T. So, you know, thanks again, AT&T, for continuing to play games with their customers. And their games continued, because we're going to talk about this in a little bit, but iOS 5.1, the new iOS update, came out last week along with the announcement of the new iPad. And after I applied the update, guess what? Suddenly I had a 4G icon on my iPhone 4S. And I thought, wow, that's amazing that a software update can go enable 4G on my hardware, considering you'd really probably need a new chipset to be able to do that. But it's there for existing 3G devices on the AT&T network. And the reason is AT&T has been pushing for a while. I don't know if I think we've talked about this. AT&T had been pushing Apple for a while to say that their 3G network, their HSDPA Plus network, is operating at 4G speeds. So it should have a 4G indicator in the menu bar. Well, I guess they won that debate. And the real thing is that there's no legal definition of what 2G, 3G, or 4G speeds are. These are just sort of made up and decided by the carriers. So AT&T considers that HSDPA Plus network to be 4G, and I guess they're going to call it 4G, but it is not 4G LTE, and I think that's going to be very very confusing for customers, for people. So you're probably going to hear a lot of your friends and family say, hey, I just upgrade. I got an upgrade on my iPhone, and I have a 4G iPhone now. Well, it's still on the same data network, but, I mean, pretty good speeds on HSDPA Plus, but nowhere near true 4G LTE. So if you want 4G LTE, iPad 2 is the only thing that's going to be able to do it, but also only in the U.S. and Canada for the LTE networks. And let's talk about why that is, too. So, again, lots of games being played, and this is the kind of detail that I really like to, you know, hold back on talking about this stuff when it's first announced so that we can get into. LTE, the technology itself, is actually heavily fragmented in terms of the frequencies and the bands. There's 32 different recognized bands available, frequencies available for LTE. And so in the U.S., AT&T and Verizon are both in the 700 megahertz band and I believe the 2.1 gigahertz band for their LTE technologies. But even within the band, they kind of have different parts of the spectrum, so they're actually too far apart for there to be a single iPad model to support both LTE networks. Like, this was the promise. They told us, you know, once it goes to LTE, everybody's going to be on a level playing field. Well, it turns out to be not really the case, I guess, because there's no standardization. Now, I think there are some people pushing for standardized LTE spectrum specs, chipsets, so that you have one device and it can be used on all the LTE networks, but that's likely to never happen. So if you want 4G LTE on AT&T, that's one version of the iPad. If you want Verizon, that is another version. And if you're international, they're going to be selling the AT&T version internationally, but then it gets even trickier because outside the U.S., it seems that they are not using necessarily the 700 megahertz band for their LTE technologies. In the U.K., for example, the 700 megahertz band is actually already in use by a TV service called Freeview. So they don't even have that frequency available to use. So there, it sounds like they're going to be using the 800 megahertz band, 2.6 gigahertz band, which incidentally is the same for Germany. And you'll still be able to use your new iPad on the current 3G networks in the UK. That runs at 2.1 gigahertz, and that is supported. But if you want to have LTE and you just bought your new iPad 4G LTE in the UK, well, guess what? You have to come over to the States and get an AT&T SIM and put it in there. So what a just nightmarish mess. And I really hope somebody sorts this out. But something to know about. And I guess there's similar problems cropping up in Australia as well. So if you live in one of these other countries and you've been researching this, because I don't get all the information from everywhere, let us know what's going on and, you know, what the carriers are doing or saying about supporting 4G LTE iPads in your region. It does say, I have to point out, it does say in the fine print on Apple's website that 4G LTE is supported on AT&T and Verizon networks in the States, Bell, Rogers, and Telus networks in Canada, and that's it. They kind of footnote it, but you know the way they're kind of marketing it on their website, it makes it sound like the iPad is this one device, world enabled, and LTE everywhere, and that's turning out not to be the case. So you should know that when you're making your buying decision. So I can see why Apple's been kind of holding off on LTE for just a number of reasons. You know, I always thought it was just the power thing, but it sounds like it's just not standardized. It's just, we're falling into all the same old technology traps that we always fall into. It's like Blu-ray, HD, DVD, VHS, Betamax. It's like, when are we ever going to learn? That just makes it confusing for consumers and hard to implement. Well, maybe someday, you know, we can always hope. One good bit of news, though, is that there was that speculation leading up to the event that the pricing might go up by about $70 per iPad. Well, that turned out not to be the case. The pricing remains exactly the same for the new iPad. So Apple's offering the 16-gigabyte model Wi-Fi for $499, 32-gigabyte Wi-Fi for $599, and 64-gigabyte Wi-Fi for $699. Again, these are the U.S. prices. The Wi-Fi plus 4G models are $129 each more, so $629 for 16 gigabytes, $729 for 32 gigabytes, and $829 for 64 gigabytes. And then, as expected, good news is that Apple did discount the pricing on the existing iPad 2. The 16 gigabyte model is still available. Wi-Fi for $399, and if you want 16 gigabyte plus 3G, it's $529 US, and all available for sale now, although we'll talk about availability here in a second. You're going to have to wait a little while longer if you want a new iPad and you didn't get your order in by now. But other great news is Apple is doing its fastest international rollout ever, so it's going to start shipping on March 16th. In Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Hong Kong, Japan, Puerto Rico, Singapore, Switzerland, the UK, and the US, and US Virgin Islands. And then following, just a week later, on the 26th, they're going to add 26 more countries. So that's Austria, Belgium, Bulgaria, Czech Republic, Denmark, Finland, Greece, Hungary, Iceland, Ireland, Italy, Liechtenstein, Luxembourg, Macau, Mexico, Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Poland, Portugal, Puerto Rico, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia, Spain, and Sweden. So lots of other countries, and the quickest rollout ever, and I have a feeling Apple is going to sell a bajillion of them. Is that an official number? Apple has not given official numbers, but they did say that sales have been off the chart. They confirmed on Sunday with the USA Today that launch day supplies were already sold out for pre-orders. They weren't saying how many pre-orders were taken, but they are going to have availability at their retail stores. The online store was completely slammed with pre-orders when they opened up. Of course, the servers went down. You couldn't get in. It took about two and a half hours for me to get my order in, and I started right from the time it became available. And even at one point, the site had come online, and they pulled it offline again. Now, the rumor I had heard was that they pulled it offline so that they could add more servers to handle the just massive demand that they were getting. And then when it came back up, it worked pretty well. I think most people got through at that point. So good news. Many of us got our orders in and they're already shipping. I got my shipping notification on Saturday. It's funny, the iPad is actually here in the States. It's actually just about an hour and a half away from me, just up north in Ontario, California, where there's a huge FedEx distribution center. But they're holding it. And the thing I read today that's kind of funny is FedEx was saying that, or leaking out of FedEx, I should be clear about this. There's rumors coming out of FedEx that Apple has actually brought their trucks into the FedEx facilities and checked in all of the new iPad 2s, but they're in Apple's trucks, and Apple's trucks are locked, and they're not going to give FedEx access to them until Thursday, the day before the iPads are supposed to ship. So at that point, FedEx will transfer them over to, I guess, to their trucks and start getting them out for delivery. And then at the Apple retail stores, there should be availability, but it's going to be on a first-come, first-served basis, and we don't know at this point when Apple is going to be opening up for sales. I did see one rumor today that said possibly 8 a.m., because I guess there's a new store opening, I think, in Texas or Tennessee, I can't remember, one of those places, and they're opening on iPad launch day on the 16th at 8 a.m. So that could be your start time. Apple also in the past has done a thing where they shut down the retail stores at 4 p.m. local time and then reopen them at 5 in the evening. But I think they're going to launch probably in the morning, which is what they've done the last few times, I think. As far as how many they might sell on launch day, Gene Munster is already coming out with his predictions. He's saying that Apple could sell up to 1 million devices on opening day. Apple didn't release opening day iPad 2 sales numbers, but most estimates from analysts pegged it at about 500,000 to 1 million. We saw a lot of numbers in the 800,000 range. It sounds like Apple is likely going to break that sales record with launch day sales, especially considering that they're launching in so many countries simultaneously. U.S. and Canadian pre-orders are now as I mentioned, delayed. It's sounding like the 19th, I think, is still the ship date if you were to order an iPad online in the U.S. or Canada now. If you're in another country, it's reported that delays are up to 2 to 3 weeks for shipping. So if you didn't get that order in right away, you're going to be waiting a little bit. But I have a feeling Apple's going to try and roll these out as quickly as possible. It might get a little more difficult in about a week when they launch those 26 other countries, though. They're going to be pushing demand for a while, I think. One thing, though, a lot of us are wondering is, you know, who is buying a new iPad? Is it iPad 1 owners who didn't upgrade last time? Is it iPad 2 owners? Is it brand new customers who haven't purchased an iPad yet? And we're going to have to find out after sales happen and we start getting some of the polls. But I've been looking at some of the online polls from the different tech sites, and Ars Technica had an interesting one. And it seemed to reflect a lot of the other reports that I'd been seeing, that about 45% of the people they polled said that they're planning on buying a new iPad. 55% said that they weren't. I have a feeling that if you're a happy iPad 2 owner, there's not a huge reason to upgrade unless you're just really wanting the latest and greatest technologies. The one thing that might put you over the top if you're on the fence is when you go into the Apple store and you look at that retina display next to your current iPad 2 display. You know, it's going to be like the experience you had when you went from the iPhone 3GS to the iPhone 4. I mean, there really is a dramatic difference. But you really have to be a technology geek, I think, to care about that kind of thing. The iPad 2 is a brilliant device, and at the new lower pricing, I think it's going to be very attractive. So I think Apple's, what they've done is they've created a good range of products at a bunch of different price points that are going to be very competitive. They're still not hitting that lower price point to compete with something like the Kindle Fire, but again, I don't think that's a market that Apple is even planning on playing in. And, you know, Apple's game is all about the margins and how much they're making on each device. And turns out that UBM Insights, or Tech Insights, excuse me, did some speculating. They looked at what they think is the components in the new iPad, and Apple's margins are still incredibly good. They're going to be a little bit lower than they were for the iPad 2, probably because of the display and the LTE technologies, but they're estimating that the 16-gigabyte LTE iPad, the cost for Apple to build that, and again, this doesn't include any of the marketing and R&D and all these other things, just the pure component costs of building it, they estimated around $310, and that would give Apple about a 50% margin on the device. I guess on the iPad 2, when they launched it, they had about a 56% margin. So only down slightly, and I think Apple's going to sell more devices than they did for iPad 2. So what they're losing in a little bit of profit margin, I think they're going to more than make up for in terms of volume. And so, you know, buying considerations, if you are thinking about buying a new iPad, you know, you have the same basic considerations. What are you going to get in terms of storage, 16, 32, or 64 gigabytes? And are you going to do the 4G model? And really, I think 4G, the answer to that is, are you going to be in places, using it in places where you have access to Wi-Fi? If the answer is, you know, most of the time I'm going to be near Wi-Fi, or I have a MiFi or some other mobile Wi-Fi hotspot, maybe you can tether your computer or something like that, then you probably can get away, save the $129 and get away with just the Wi-Fi model. If you're going to be out and about and you need to get access to a cellular data network, because it's month to month and no contract, I think it's a pretty good deal to get the LTE version, the 4G version. And as far as whether you get AT&T or Verizon, frankly, I'm not a huge Verizon fan, but I'm becoming less and less of an AT&T fan. And the fact that Verizon will let you tether your iPad on, you know, starting on launch day without any additional cost, I think that's the better choice in the States. I'm not sure how the Canadian plans compare. So if you've been weighing Canadian plans and can chime in on that, send us a voicemail or an email, something like that, and we'll try and share that on the next episode of the MacCast. But I think really it comes down to storage in terms of which model am I going to get storage-wise. And from there, you know, I know Apple's leaning heavily on iCloud, so you might look at, well, I can do iTunes Match or iTunes in the cloud for my music, and I can now re-download and stream and get my movies and TV shows and stuff over the network. So if you're that type of person and you don't mind having to re-download and manage stuff, you probably can get away with the smaller versions of the iPad. But Macworld did an interesting thing. They looked at Apple's apps that they've now optimized for the Retina display. And that means all of the assets, all of the graphics files and icons and stuff like that are resed up. And I think in some cases, they even have two different versions of those assets. So they took a look at how much bigger are Retina display optimized new iPad apps versus the iPad 2 versions of those applications. And what they discovered is that in most cases, the app sizes went up by a factor of 2 to 3 times. So that's some significant bulk. For example, Keynote went from 115 megabytes to 327 megabytes. Numbers went from 109 megabytes to 283 megabytes. Pages from 95 to 269. And iMovie went from 70 to 404 megabytes. Now, that's not a fair comparison because they added that new trailers feature to the new version of iMovie for the iPad. So there's a lot of assets and extra stuff that goes in there. But the point is still made that, you know, developers have to up-res or create larger assets to support the new Retina display. And so app sizes are going to go up a little bit. And one thing that's going to happen is that's not just going to impact new iPad owners. It's also going to impact you when you go to upgrade your apps. They're going to be a little bit bigger. They're going to eat up a little bit more storage because developers have a couple options to do the optimizing. Right out of the box, launch day, without doing anything else, the applications will just upscale for the new iPad screen. And because it's an even ratio, a 2x, you know, increase in terms of the resolution in both directions, so it's actually 4 times the number of pixels, it'll just scale up and it'll look pretty good. But if they want to make Retina-sized assets, they'll either have to create all new Retina versions and then let those scale down for the iPad 2, or I think to get the best quality, a lot of developers will actually create 2 versions of the same assets, one for the iPad 2 and one for the iPad 3. That'll give better quality and better experience, but it's also going to bloat the app size a little bit more. So that's a significant consideration. And then I saw another article, you know, commenting on newsstand. So if you get your magazines through the iPad or your newspapers, a lot of those publishers are just putting out JPEG or PDF versions of those magazines. So you have a few hundred pages in a magazine like Wired, and it's all high-res JPEGs, and now those are going to be sized up for Retina. That's going to significantly increase the size of your magazine. I think my Wireds are already about 300, 400, 500 megabytes. So those could double, triple, quadruple in size. And so that's going to start eating up a lot of your storage. It'd be nice if publishers would recognize that and move to a better technology like HTML5, create, you know, HTML5 web standard versions of those magazines. And that way text could be text. You can, you know, you don't have to have everything be an image, which is what is really going to contribute to the size bloat. And I think Apple's really thinking about this too, because they are supporting 1080p for movies, TV shows, but when you download them from iTunes, they're only a little bit larger than their 720p counterparts. And the reason for that, apparently, is that Apple is using and supporting a new technology, a new high-profile compression for H.264, and that's enabled by the newer chipsets, by the A5 and the A5X that's in the iPad, the Apple TV, the iPad 2, and the iPhone 4S. And they have an improved decoder, level 4.1 decoder that enables them to deal with this new high-profile compression. So it makes it possible for them to achieve and support higher maximum bit rates on those devices. And that's enabling Apple to put out 1080p content that's only slightly larger. For example, I downloaded a TV show in 720p resolution, HD, and 1080p, and it was a half-hour show, and the difference in size was 800 megabytes versus 700 megabytes. So it was about 100 megabyte difference between the two different versions. And so you gain a lot of quality, a lot more pixels for not a lot more file size. So Apple's obviously thinking about storage considerations on these devices. And when I went to make my buying decision, I ended up going with a 64 gigabyte model just because I am already managing on my 32 gigabyte iPhone, having to manage my content a little bit too much, at least for my own tastes. Now, it may totally change. I may decide, you know, I'm getting a lot of stuff from the cloud, I'm re-downloading things, and maybe I didn't need all the storage, but I like having the headroom. So if you're like me, you might consider getting a slightly larger one. And, you know, we all know with iPads, you can't add in that storage later. But Man, we've got a lot of stuff to get to, and I've already talked about a lot with just respect to the new iPad. But that wasn't the only thing that Apple announced. They announced a bunch of other new products, including a new Apple TV. Good news is that the feature list on the new Apple TV is pretty small. Really, all that changed, the hardware is almost exactly the same with respect to most pieces, the HDMI input, the Ethernet cable, the power cable, same form factor, same size, same little black box. But Apple did add 1080p support. There's a new UI in the operating system, although you can get that on the Apple TV 2. It's a software update, a download that you can get. The new Apple TV does bump the processor up, though, to a custom A5 processor. It's a single-core A5, and that's likely to support the new 1080p video playback that I was talking to you about earlier. And another nice benefit of the new Apple TV is that digital copies of movies that are in iTunes are now available for streaming on your Apple TV too. So if you bought a physical disc, a Blu-ray, or a DVD, and you unlocked the iTunes digital copy of that, you can now re-download that through your Apple and stream it to your Apple TV. I guess it's not really downloading because the Apple TV doesn't have storage. It's streaming to the Apple TV. So there's that. And I think I forgot one of the most significant announcements about the new iPad and the new Apple TV is the naming. You notice that it's not the iPad 3 or Apple TV 3. Apple is just simply calling them the new iPad, the new Apple TV. So there was a lot of debate on what it was going to be called and where it was going to be confusing and not confusing. And I think Apple did the right thing. I think this actually makes it more consistent across their entire product line. With the Macs, we have the iMac, the MacBook Pro. There's not really a distinction when Apple comes out with a new model of any kind of numbering or versioning. It sounds like they're going to be consistent with that across all their devices. So I have to imagine that when the new iPhone comes out, the iPhone 5, it's actually just going to be called the new iPhone, or just simply iPhone, and we're going to have to use that kind of internal designation so that we can distinguish between the different models. So a lot of the sites are calling the new iPad the iPad third generation, and maybe it'll be the iPhone fifth generation, that sort of thing. But just an iPhone, just an Apple TV. And I think I already alluded to this, but as Apple is oft to do, they also updated the operating system in advance of the new hardware coming out. So iOS 5.1 was released. It has some significant new changes. It's a free download available for existing iOS customers on the iPhone, iPad, and iPod Touch. You can get it via iTunes, or you can just do the over-the-air software update. So if you go into your settings, general software updates, you can check for it there. And that's actually how I picked it up. For some reason, right when it launched, Apple's servers were overloaded. I'm not really sure why. Maybe all those people ordering new iPads. Yeah, Apple was having some troubles that day. But I was able to get it over the air and download it. And it's got some nice new additions. One of the most noticeable ones right up front, you're going to see that the lock screen is a little bit different. It now has fast access to the camera right from the lock screen. So they've kind of moved the slide to unlock over a little bit. And now you have a camera icon always there, always visible. And it's got these little handles. You just slide it up and it goes right into the camera. You can swipe down once you're in the camera to get back to the lock screen. And one thing I particularly like is that a simple flick motion will just, you know, throw it right into the camera mode. So you can just with a tap and a flick of your thumb, get right into snapping a picture. And that's going to be nice for those moments when you need to get to the camera mode very quickly. Another big addition that a lot of people are happy about, and this comes through a number of different upgrades, including the iOS 5.1 update, but also update to iPhoto, is you can now delete photos from your iCloud photo stream. And the way you do that is you go into the Photos application, you tap on the little action button, and then you tap delete, and then you just confirm that you want to delete the images from your iOS device. Now, something you need to know about this is it's a little bit confusing when you first use it, that when you delete a photo, it only deletes that item on the device if that photo was taken prior to the 5.1 update. Any photos that were taken after the 5.1 update and that are in your photo stream, when you delete those, it deletes it from the device and also from the entire stream, so all of your other devices. And that wasn't really clear to me at first. You know, it slides down. It's really, really interesting. It gives you a message. So you go to delete something for the photo stream. And the first time I did it, I think I was deleting a photo that I had in my photo stream for a while. So it was an older photo, and it said, oh, this is only going to delete this from this device. And I thought, that's odd. That's not very user-friendly if I'm going to have to go manually delete the photo on every single photo stream on every single device that I had. And then I was testing it further, you know, taking some pictures, and then went to delete that one. And it said, hey, this is going to delete from all your devices. I went, well, which is it? And doing some research on Apple's support website revealed the real answer. And that's that anything prior to 5.1, you're going to have to delete manually from all your devices. After that, it's going to work as expected. Delete at one place, it deletes across your entire photo stream. And if you want to delete photos from your photo stream in iPhoto, it works exactly the same way. You just need to grab the iPhoto 9.2.2 update. So you can get that through Apple's software update utility or on Apple's support website at apple.com/support. Real quickly, some other updates to iOS 5.1. You can now get Siri in Japanese, although I read a report today that Siri in Japanese may not be quite as accurate as it is in other languages. So it sounds like Apple released it. They still have some kinks to work out. I think it's hard to forget that Siri really is still beta. Apple didn't point that out really in the keynote, and they probably should have reminded people about that. But overall, Siri works pretty well, and I guess just learning languages for anybody, including Siri, is just a little bit tricky. But if you're in Japan and been using Siri in Japanese, let us know how it's working out for you. I already mentioned the 4G network indicator on the menu bar on AT&T devices. Very interesting, but still 3G AT&T. And now this next one is something that Apple didn't add. They actually took away. I don't know if this functionality was supposed to be there. I'm guessing not, since Apple has removed it. It must have been a bug. But somebody had discovered, or a few people had discovered, that there were these cool URLs that you could load in Safari that would actually take you directly to settings within iOS. So you could create through the homepage icon, you know, the ability to create icons on your home screen from a URL, you could create these buttons that would automatically take you to, say, your Bluetooth settings or your Wi-Fi settings in one tap. And a lot of people really liked these and were using them. Well, Apple took those away with the 5.1 update. So if you've been using those, just be aware of that. You'll no longer have access to those. Something I am very excited about, podcasting updates. I kind of thought Apple had forgotten a little bit about podcasting, but this one is in the iPad music player only. You know, the iPad music player we've talked about has a very different UI and didn't support a lot of the podcasting controls that you have on other iOS devices like the iPhone or iPod Touch. Well, now there is 30-second skip back and speed controls in the player in the iPad for podcasts. So really good addition. Another nice addition with respect to music is now your iTunes Match. If you have that service, your Genius Mixes and Playlists are supported. The camera UI, we already talked about the home screen button, but also on the iPad got a whole new user interface. And I would imagine that's because the new iPad is going to have that nice camera on it, and people are probably going to be using the camera app a little bit more on their iPad. It supports the face detection. On the iPhone, you can now highlight up to 10 faces, not just the most prominent face. Audio enhancements. This one's really interesting. There's audio enhancements for TV and movies on the iPad. Apple claims that somehow they've made the audio clearer and louder, although I don't think the speakers have changed any. So they must be applying a little bit more audio filtering. Actually, there's always some amazing things that you can do by just tweaking different things with sound filtering and stuff like that. So making it sound better, you're probably focusing on voice for movies and stuff like that. Now that people are going to be watching 1080p videos, you want really good audio to go right along with that. Bug fixes for battery life, especially on the iPhone 4S. I was so happy to hear this one. And so far, my battery life on my iPhone 4S seems to be very much improved. It's not going down nearly as quickly as it had been, and I'm very, very happy for that. I'll have to let you know. You know, I've only had it for a few days now, but so far so good. Seems pretty good, and I'd love to get your reports. If you're finding your battery life's better or worse, let us know about it, and we'll kind of track that a little bit. thing that I haven't seen yet because of my battery life, I hadn't enabled this feature, but apparently iReminders now shows you when you have geofencing turned on in the menu bar. You get the little location status icon, but it's just an outline, and that indicates that you have some iReminder geofencing reminders turned on. There's some new security restrictions inside the parental controls. So if you go into Settings, General Restrictions, you'll see now there's a profanity filter for Siri. So Siri, if you're using that foul language, we can now wash your mouth out with soap. And you can actually completely disable Siri or block location services or the ability to change location services or settings. And those go along with another tool that I'm going to tell you about here in a little bit. Cellular data. This is not necessarily related to the iOS 5.1 update, but the timing was exactly the same. It used to be that your cellular data, downloading over cellular data, you had a 20 megabyte limit. That limit has been raised to 50 megabytes, and that'll be pretty good for MacCast listeners because most of my episodes, I think, were just over 20 megabytes, but under 30 megabytes, between 30 and 40 megabytes. So you'll be able to download over cellular if you want the MacCast. Just keep an eye on your cellular data limits. I don't want anybody going over. And you can actually control that. If you go into settings for the store, you can toggle on or off whether it will use cellular data. And so if you're worried about going over, you might want to make sure that that's ticked off. And that way you'll never be able to download except over Wi-Fi anything from the iTunes store or the App Store, something like that. And as I mentioned earlier, along with the iOS 5.1 update for iPhones, iPod Touches, and iPads, Apple also released an update to the Apple TV. Version 5.0 brings the new user interface to the Apple TV 2. If you need to get it, you just go on your Apple TV into Settings, into General, check for updates. I downloaded mine almost right away. I really like the look of the new home screen. It gives you much quicker access to everything that's in there. So essentially what happens is it replaces that old menu system with all of these tiles that allow you to access all your services. And right across the top, you have movies, TV shows, music, computers, and settings. And then under that, you have all of the other services that are available on the Apple TV that used to be really buried down inside, most of them down inside, I think that internet menu, was that what it was called? I don't even remember now because the new UI is so much nicer. So you now can see Netflix, NBA, NHL, the trailers, MLB, the Wall Street Journal, YouTube, Vimeo, your podcast, the radio, the photo stream, your Mobile Me photos, your Flickr photos, all of that stuff right there on the home screen and just jump into it. And then once you're inside those menus, you have a navigation up at the top. Get nice big artwork. I think Apple pointed out that they can have bigger album art and artwork for movies and TV shows, which makes it a little bit easier to see. It seems to me like it's a little bit easier to read, too. So I don't know if they've bumped up the font size or if there's space for more text. But once you're inside a menu, you're kind of in there and you can go back and forth and then scroll along the menu items at the top. And when you scroll down, that menu bar hides. And if you want to get it back, you can just press the menu button and then the menu bar slides back down or scroll back up to the top. Another thing in the update is there's new screensavers. There's National Geographic photo screensavers if you don't want to use your own, but I like using my own photos. And then also Netflix came out and said that they had added on-device sign-up for Netflix. And so you can pay for Netflix, get your Netflix subscription right on the Apple TV using your Apple ID through in-app purchase. So that's pretty cool. And then one other small tweak Apple made to the preferred video resolution settings in the iTunes Store menu. I believe it used to say standard definition or HD. It now says 720p HD, and I assume that's in preparation for the new Apple TV, which will also offer up the 1080p HD resolution as an option. So that's the update to the Apple TV, and if you want to upgrade your Apple TV 2, you can actually do that today. And let's see, what's next here? Oh, iTunes. iTunes 10.6 came out. It has a number of features and enhancements, most notably the ability to play and purchase 1080p movie and TV shows from the iTunes store. They also updated iTunes Match and fixed a few things, better song matching, downloading, and better displaying of album artwork, or I guess it says displaying of album artwork. I'm hoping better matching of album artwork. Have you run into that problem with iTunes Match? Hopefully we get better album art and more accurate album art is really what I'm looking for. They addressed an issue that could cause some songs to skip when playing from iCloud. So if you noticed that, that hopefully is resolved. You can, because of the new TV content, change your store preferences now from 720p, which I believe is the default, to 1080p HD downloads. Just go under preferences under store and you should see that setting there. One thing to remember about that though is that the iPad, the new iPad, the new Apple TV, and the iPhone 4S are the only devices I think that support that playback because of the processor needed, or that's my assumption. And the iPad and the Apple TV, the new Apple TV, are the only devices that will actually play back 1080p. On the iPhone 4S, it's actually scaled down, I believe, to 720p. So just keep that in mind, because your file sizes are going to go up just a little bit, as I was mentioning earlier. There's also a new option for down-converting your audio files when you sync them to your device. This is under the iTunes Preferences General setting. In the past, there's been a checkbox there that says Convert Higher Bitrate Songs, and that happens when you sync music over to your device to help save on storage space. It was defaulted to 128 kilobits per second. That was kind of the only choice that you had. You now have a drop-down menu there offering 128, 192, or 256 kilobits per second on the downsampling. There was a new terms of service put out along with the iTunes update that you'll have to agree to, but something of significance that was in there is that Apple publishers may now offer a free trial period via in-app subscriptions for their products. So I have a feeling that's for magazines and newspapers to allow you to kind of get a free issue before you actually commit to making a purchase. So that'll be kind of nice to see if that does come to fruition. So at least it's kind of opening the doors for that. And I think that's mostly what's in the new iTunes update. Side update, not necessarily related to iTunes, but somewhat, is iBooks Author. iBooks Author did get an update, and it was updated to support the iPad's new Retina display. So I have to imagine that some of the widgets and themes and stuff like that that you use for iBooks Author are now upgraded to include the higher resolution assets for the new Retina display. And then on iTunes itself, I did have one of you report to me that iTunes was crashing after upgrading. And this was one on a system running Lion 10.7.2, but was using the old version of iPhoto, iPhoto 09. And it turned out that the fix was to upgrade to iPhoto 11, and that resolved the issue. I had been pointed to a discussion thread where a number of people were reporting this issue after upgrading to iTunes 10.6, so I wanted to point it out in case any of you have been hit by that. It kind of seems odd that you'd have to upgrade your iPhoto, though. I hope that's a bug, and hopefully that's something that Apple will address quickly. If you ran into this issue and you have another fix or have found another solution, let us know, because I'd hate to have to force people to upgrade from iPhoto 9 to iPhoto 11 just to use iTunes. The two are, you know, somewhat related, but really shouldn't be that tightly coupled. And along with the updates for the desktop, Apple did go through and update a number of their iOS applications. Specifically, the iLife suite was updated. All of the applications were updated for Apple's new iPad Retina display. That was across the board. And then individual apps, starting with GarageBand. GarageBand got some really nice updates. You can now go in and individually edit notes on an instrument track. So if you double tap on the track, it will bring up the editor, and you can change the pitch, the duration, and the velocity of individual notes. You can even change groups of notes, and the changes are applied proportionally and maintaining the relationships between the notes. So you can do a whole selection and then say adjust pitch, and all of the notes will adjust accordingly within that selection. So that's pretty cool. There's a new smart string instrument. So just like the smart guitar, or smart piano, some of those other ones, you can now do a whole string quartet if you want to right inside the application. They also added the ability to merge tracks. So that means, you know, up until this update, you had been limited to 8-track recording on the iPad, but now you can actually merge 2 tracks together. I think they call that bouncing down tracks in the old school days, right? You can take your 8 tracks and compress them down to 1, and that frees up 7 more tracks to do additional recording. So you can do all kinds of multi-tracking and stuff like that right on the device. They added some additional sharing options. So you have YouTube, Facebook, SoundCloud, and iMovie now. So you can send right to iMovie. That's kind of cool. And those are in addition to the iTunes and mail export options. I think that already existed. There's also iCloud Song Sync. I'm not really sure how that works. I'm assuming that's just your all of your tracks syncing between your iOS devices. There was an update to GarageBand on the desktop, but I didn't see iCloud support in there. So I don't think, I think that's kind of like iWork. A little frustrated with Apple's iCloud integration on the desktop not being integrated makes it, I think, a little less useful. But iCloud Song Sync's there in GarageBand. And a really cool feature that I think a lot of people are very excited about is something called Jam Session. And that allows you to take up to four devices and put them in a little ad hoc network and record a song together. And it uses Wi-Fi or Bluetooth. And then you have a leader. So one person kind of starts up a jam session, and then up to three other devices can join in on that with the virtual instruments. And then you play, and by default, at the end of your session, it will auto collect all the recordings, all the different tracks onto the leader's device. And then from that point, you can take off and do editing. But you can actually also turn off the auto collection feature and allow everybody to record and then edit their tracks locally and then manually collect the tracks down to the leader's device. And then because you can do the track merging and stuff like that, you can actually do multi-tracking and overdubbing. So you could have four people in a jam session record four tracks and then capture all of those and then go back and add four additional tracks, so you now have eight tracks, and then you can start to bounce those down, and I would imagine add in more tracks on top of that. So you can do some very sophisticated music creation and editing right on an iPad now. And as I mentioned, GarageBand 11 for the Mac did get upgraded to version 6.0.5. They added some updates for compatibility with GarageBand on iOS. They fixed a playback issue with GarageBand Lessons, and they also corrected some issues with some of the software instruments triggering incorrect or stuck notes. And so that's GarageBand. iMovie was also updated on iOS. It didn't get nearly the volume of updates as GarageBand, but they did add the new movie trailers, which I mentioned earlier. It has a brand new icon. There was also some additional graphics changes, including a revised undo button that brings it more in line and makes it more consistent with GarageBand and iPhoto. Yes, I said iPhoto. We're going to talk about that in a second. There's now a button to preview audio within the audio browser, so you can hear that. And that probably goes along with the export to iMovie from GarageBand. Now that you're bringing your tracks in, you're going to deal with music a little bit more on iMovie. And, of course, exporting and playback of 1080p video, I would imagine, on supported devices. And there's now a new swipe up gesture in the timeline that'll allow you to add a freeze frame within your video project on iMovie. So that's the updates to iMovie. And if you're already a GarageBand or an iMovie owner on iOS, these updates are free and available in the App Store right now, so you can grab them. And then Apple released, I think, one of the most exciting things, a brand new app into the iLife suite on iOS, and that's iPhoto. And iPhoto is absolutely amazing on the iPad and the iPhone. And it does work universal, both on iPhones and iPads. You can download it. It's $4.99 US on the App Store. And when you're editing, you get all the basic editing tools like auto enhance, adjusting the orientation. You can flag, favorite, or hide items within your iPhoto library. And then there is a toolbox for doing your editing. And within that, you have crop and straighten. You have exposure controls, color, brushes, and effects. And there's this cool little magnifier that you can bring up when you're editing your photos through this special gesture. You tap and hold with two fingers on the display, and up will zoom this magnifier. And then, you know, so it's kind of like a pinch position, or almost think like, you know, turning a dial or something like that. Hold your fingers like that, press them on the screen and this loop will come up. And then you can twist inside the loop to adjust the magnification level. It's a really cool effect. A lot of sounds in iPhoto for iOS. I'm not sure how I feel about those yet, but a lot of whooping and whooshing kinds of sounds. And the whole interface itself, just for the record, is kind of swishy. Kind of taking some cues, I think, from Lion. I had talked about the fact that, you know, things zooming in and out all over the place in iPhoto on iOS. So I don't know if I really how I really feel about that yet, but it's there. One really nice thing that I was looking forward to seeing is access to the metadata and the EXIF data that's on your photos. And it includes access to comments if you shared your photos to Flickr or Facebook, just like on the desktop. You can see any comments that might come in on those shared photos. Has support for geolocation data and the mapping information, but what's interesting is when you look at that, it doesn't look like it's using Google Maps. And there's a theory that Apple is actually using the OpenStreetMaps project, which is an open source project, which shows that they may be moving away from Google. It also is interesting to note that Apple's not using their own mapping technology. Apple's purchased three major mapping companies and with different kinds of technologies recently. So there's been a lot of speculation that Apple might be working on its own mapping stuff, but it looks like it's going with the OpenStreetMap stuff for now. At the very least, moving away from Google. And we know that Apple and Google have had a falling out over Android. So that kind of makes sense. Cool feature for selecting photos. If you need to edit or work on a group of photos, you can now double tap a photo in the library and it will select all similar photos to that one photo. And this is very useful when you're editing on a device, especially like an iPhone, because you can go in and you can work on one photo and you can make all kinds of color adjustments and corrections to that. And then you can copy just those adjustments and then apply them to all the similar photos. And that makes that process really easy. It does have albums, photos, events, and something called journals. And what's cool about journals is it allows you to publish your journals to iCloud. And so really, it looks like Apple has brought back what in essence amounts to iPhoto galleries and iWeb sharing with the journals feature. Unfortunately, journals aren't supported in iPhoto on the desktop yet, but the way they work in iPhoto on iOS is you can select a bunch of photos, you can add them to a journal, and then once you're in the journal, you can edit that, you can move them around, and it'll work just like a gallery if you just have photos in there. But then there's also all these little widgets, things like headers and text and notes and memories and spaces, and you can add in map data and calendar information, like what day it was shot on or what day that journal applies to and what the weather was for that day. And it'll use the geolocation data and some of the other data in the photos to kind of pre-fill out or deduce that information. You can add quotes and food and just, you know, talk about your experience related to those photos and put it all in this little journal project. And then you can publish that right to iCloud. And once you've done that, you can get a link that you can share with people to access your journal, basically what amounts to your photo gallery. Now, it doesn't look like there's any kind of public URL for that. There's not like the home pages on Mac.com or on MobileMe, but it is a way to actually share photo galleries. And I'm really hoping that'll make its way into iPhoto. It has very much like a digital scrapbook kind of feel. So in some ways, it's, you know, like galleries on iWeb where you could combine different elements through these little widgets. And it's a nice little addition to the app. The iPhoto for iOS is supported on the iPhone, iPod Touch, and iPad 2s. I think anything with a camera. Now, some people noted that when they purchased it through iTunes and then tried to install it on an original iPad, it gave a warning saying that it wasn't supported because it didn't have a camera. Well, it turns out the same hack that worked for iMovie, remember when iMovie came out and you could actually get it to install on an original iPad without a camera? That same workaround does work apparently with iPhoto. Now, you need to be very careful with this because it uses Apple's Enterprise iPhone Configuration Utility. That's something you can get through Apple's website. And it allows you to add applications and then deploy those to different iPads. It's designed for like an IT administrator to admin a bunch of iPads. But you can actually use it to push iPhoto onto an original iPad. Now, when you do this, if you go back into iTunes and try and sync, it's going to warn you that the application isn't authorized. And if you don't authorize it, it will be removed from your device. So you have to click authorize in iTunes and then enter your Apple ID to authorize that application. The report that I read said that at that point, that warning should go away and it should allow you to use iTunes normally. In my case, that didn't work. And I had the same experience when I tried this hack with iMovie. It didn't allow me to authorize the application. It just kind of got stuck in this loop. So I would make sure that you have a backup before you try this trick and just be very careful. I mean, really, the worst thing that happens is if you can't authorize it, then it just removes the application from the device and you have to go back to the enterprise iPhone configuration utility to get it back on. But that whole going back and forth makes it a little bit inconvenient to do syncing and stuff like that. The one option would be to completely turn off application syncing within iTunes itself and then just use the iPhone configuration utility. But again, it's really kind of a hassle. So this is more just a hack around in case you want to play with iMovie on an older device. And incidentally, I was able to also install iMovie on an iPhoto on an iPhone 3GS, which I don't think that's a supported device out of the box. So if you want to get iPhoto for iOS, it's $4.99 on the App Store and available now. And as I mentioned, there is an iPhoto 11 update, 9.2.2, which adds support for deleting photos from PhotoStream. And then somewhat related to the iPhone Enterprise Configuration Utility, that's the one that's available on Apple's website. I think if you go to apple.com/enterprise, you can find the link to it. Apple released a new version of that application through the Mac App Store. Over there, it's called the Apple Configurator, and it makes it easy to configure and mass deploy iPhones, iPads, or iPod Touches in a school, business, or institutional situation. It's a little more simplified interface from the Enterprise iPhone Configuration Utility, a lot cleaner. It will allow you to update 30 different devices at a time, so you can upgrade them to the latest version of iOS. You can configure the settings. You can maintain standard configurations across a batch of devices. You can install all the same apps, put all the same data onto those devices. And while you can only manage 30 devices at a time, you can actually create multiple sets of 30 different devices. So if you're in IT, if you need to remote manage a bunch of devices, this tool will allow you to do that. It also has the ability to assign users through your Open Directory or Active Directory, and you can check out and assign specific devices to specific people. And your IT staff can set up standard configurations. You can set up approved policies. You can control parental controls and personalization on the device, so you can add user's picture to their lock screen so you know whose device it is. And it is designed as a replacement to that iPhone configuration utility. Now, interestingly enough, though, the hack that I just told you about for getting iPhoto onto an iPad 1 or an older iOS device, that will not work with the configurator application. So you need to get the Enterprise iPhone configuration utility if you want to do that hack. But both those are available, and you get the configuration app through the App Store on the Mac. Okay, believe it or not, we are almost done with all of the updates. Actually, this next update isn't really an update. It's another thing that Apple is removing. Friday after the announcement, Apple announced that iWork.com, a service which had been in beta for a while, is going to be discontinued, just like .Mac, although it's happening a month later. It's being shut down on July 31st, 2012. Apple is saying that as a replacement for iWork.com, they recommend doing sharing through iCloud, which is fine if you're just planning on sharing iWork documents between your own devices and your Mac, but doesn't address one of the major features of iWork.com, which was the ability to publish iWork documents in a space where you could work on them collaboratively and get feedback and make comments and things like that. People could download your iWork documents, make changes, and that sort of thing. And it also doesn't address any of the sharing features. You could publish your documents to iWork.com and then get a link that you could send out to people so that they could view and download those online. I just actually used iWork.com for the first time on Friday to put out a keynote presentation that I had done to share with a group of people. And they could view it online. It even gave you like embed code you could put on your own website. So it was a cool service. I think not that many people knew about it or used it. It was built right into iWork, but it's going away now. So I guess it's kind of a moot point. So if you are using iWork.com, make sure that you pull down all your information, all your data by July 31st before that service goes away. And then the last update, yes, we've got to the last one. It came out today. Safari was updated to version 5.1.4. It's available for Lion and Snow Leopard. Bunch of items in there. I'm not going to go through all of them, but most important, they've improved the JavaScript performance. I think that's up about 11%. And they also added an update that I'm excited about where links that are in your web pages, when you save the web page to PDF, those are maintained and hyperlinkable. I actually didn't know that that wasn't working before, or wasn't there before, but it's specifically noted in the release notes. So if you want to run Software Update Utility, you should see Safari 5.1.4 if you're running Lion or Snow Leopard, or you can get that through Apple's support website at apple.com/support. And that is going to do it for the news. For now, before we move on, I want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze. You know, if you are in a situation where you need to manage a bunch of Macs that are in a shared computer environment, so if you're in the hospitality industry, if you're in a business or a government organization, if you're in a school and you're managing a lab full of computers, you have the situation where you need to set up, you need to get all of the systems up and running with a common installation, same operating system, same applications, and now you've got all these different users that are going to be logging into those systems, they're going to be using them, they're going to be downloading stuff, they're going to be surfing the web, they're going to be doing all kinds of things on those computers, and you're going to have to maintain those. You're going to have to make sure they don't get viruses, they don't get weird stuff on them, people don't leave files strewn all over the systems, and Deep Freeze is the product to manage and handle that and make that whole process easy. Because what it does is it allows you to set up the system and then take that configuration, all those applications, all those things, and freeze it. Lock that configuration in place. And then when the users go on the system, they can use it freely. They can download stuff. They can put files all over the system. They can trash things in the system folder. They can do pretty much whatever you want to allow them to do. And they could completely hose up that system. And all you have to do to restore it is reboot it. You reboot it. Deep Freeze kicks in. It goes, oh, I know how this system's supposed to be set up. And it restores it back to pristine, new condition, just like the day you deployed it. So one fail swoop and you're done. And that saves you time. It saves you IT costs. It makes your users happier. And what's cool is, you know, users are going to need to be able to keep their data somewhere. They might have to store files on there. So they have this concept called thaw spaces, which allows you to take a folder, a volume, an entire user account, whatever you want, and say, this space is okay. That's for the users. They can keep their documents and files there. Don't touch that between reboots. Just restore the operating system and the applications and all that stuff. All completely managed. You can also integrate it with your remote management tools. It's available for Mac and PC. So if you're in a mixed environment, it'll handle that. And you really should check it out. They have free demos and trials available, and you can get more information over at Phoronix.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. All right, let's get to some of your comments, your feedback, your questions and stuff like that. One of my favorite parts of the show. And I'm going to kick things off this week with a question about mail.app and specifically with IMAP accounts and the drafts folder. And some of you might already be know where I'm leading with this question. But what happens is if you set up an IMAP account and you've mapped all your folders and you've set up things so that the drafts folder is mapped to a folder, an IMAP folder on your server. And there's a very good reason to do this. You'd want to do this because that would give you the ability to start an email on one system, say on your Mac, save it to the drafts folder, and then be on your iPad later or your iPhone later and call up the drafts folder on the server and finish up that email and then send it. Great application, something that I'd really like the ability to do, but for whatever reason, mail.app seems to have somewhat of a problem with that whole scenario. It will often leave a version of the drafts message behind in one of those IMAP locations locally. So it's supposed to sync, but for some reason it seems like the syncing's a little bit broken. So I want to cover a couple tips here. The first thing is, if you don't know how to map your local IMAP folders, the folders on your Mac, to the respective folders on your IMAP server, you should probably know how to do that, because not every IMAP server uses the same kind of folder names. So you have to tell mail.app, okay, this is the drafts folder on my Mac. This is the one that it matches to that's in the cloud, that's up on the server. So if you are in mail.app, you know, up there at the top, you have all your different accounts and you have the different sort of default mailboxes sorted out. You'll have your inbox and you'll have your sent folder and your outbox folder and the junk mail folder. They're all kind of up there, and then you'll have one of those for each account. And those are the local ones by default if Apple Mail.app hasn't matched those already to the folders that are on your IMAP server in the cloud. And they may or may not, again, dependent upon the name of those folders. Inbox generally matches by default, but some of the other ones may or may not have matched. So for some of your accounts, you might not see, say, a sent messages folder, or a sent mail folder, or a trash. And if you don't see that, then you're going to need to go in and you're going to want to map them. You might want to map, you know, them anyway, but the way you do that is you scroll down the list there, and when you scroll down from that sort of default set of folders or mailboxes, you should see the individual accounts, and then within that, you should see the individual mailboxes or folders that that server has and have synced up to mail.app. So you'll see common folders for things like sent or sent messages. You might see trash. You might see spam or junk. So, you know, some servers call it spam. Some call it junk. Some call it junk mail. You might also see a drafts folder there. And what you want to do is, under that list for that account, you want to find the folder that you want to map to the ones at the top, select it, and then go under the mailbox menu, and you'll see a use this mailbox for option. If you go under that, you'll see a list, and you'll have the options for sent, trash, or junk. And you can map any specific mailbox on the IMAP account to the mailboxes on your Mac. So for drafts, you're going to want to map the draft folder to the draft folder on the IMAP server. And once you've done that, then in theory, what should happen is when you start composing a message on your Mac and save it to drafts, it's going to get saved to the drafts folder locally and then synced up to the drafts folder on your IMAP server. And with most mailboxes, that seems to work just fine. If something comes into your inbox and it syncs to the inbox, it's on your all your devices in the inbox, and that seems to work. Same thing with trash, same thing with junk mail. Those all seem to work fine. For whatever reason, very often I will be working on a draft message. I'll save a copy to the drafts, or maybe even not save a copy to the drafts, and send that email, and then days later I'm working along, and hey, there's a message in my drafts folder. What's going on with that? And sometimes I'll have multiple copies of the same draft message in the drafts folder. I don't know what's happening. My theory is that mail is auto-saving versions of drafts in the background, and so when you go to send an actual message, you're sending the latest version, but it's kind of leaving these little bits and pieces behind. And the only fix I know for this issue is to actually just completely disable of saving draft messages on the server. And that works. You won't end up with these extra copies of the draft messages floating around. But the downside is that you lose the ability to start a message in one location and then pick it up and finish it in another. But if you want to avoid having these sort of orphaned draft messages in mail.app, what you need to do is you need to go into preferences. You need to select the account that's having the issue. And then you need to click on the mailbox behaviors tab for that account. And then under the drafts section, there's a checkbox that says store draft messages on server. If you uncheck that, then it won't try and sync those up to the server, and it'll only kind of hold on to the local copy. And once you do that, it seems to resolve this issue of having these extra draft messages floating around. And you'll want to do the same thing on your iOS devices. So in iOS, it's a little bit different. You go into settings, mail, contacts, and calendars. You click on the account, and then you click on account advanced. And then you go under the mailbox behaviors, and you click the drafts mailbox. And then that'll go into a submenu, and you can change the on the server drafts mailbox to the on my iPhone drafts mailbox. You'll see two of them. You just need to change where the checkbox is. And then once you've done that, then again, any draft messages for that account that you're working on your iOS device will stay local, and they won't try and sync to the server, and you won't end up with these orphan drafts. So that's how you do it, and I appreciate the person who sent along that question, because I know it can be highly annoying when you see all those extra draft messages floating around. I was mentioning earlier that a cool feature of the new iPad is its support for the next generation Bluetooth, but iPads have had Bluetooth support for a while, and one of the cool things you can do with that is you can pair up a keyboard with a Bluetooth keyboard with your iPad and use it almost like a laptop. You know, it really makes typing a lot simpler, and I got this comment and question from David related to that.
Hi, Adam. This is David in Pittsburgh, and I have a quick question about using my iPad with my Apple Bluetooth keyboard. I got an iPad 2 when they first came out, and I absolutely love it, but so far it's mostly been a supplement to my Mac. But a couple days ago, my MacBook Pro died, and the geniuses tell me I'm going to be without it for about a week. So I've been learning to rely on my iPad for things I hadn't needed it for before. And so I connected it to my external display, and I connected it to my Bluetooth keyboard, and I was pleasantly surprised to learn that things like the volume keys and the brightness keys work with it, although I guess I shouldn't be surprised since Apple's good at details like that. And after a bit of Googling, I learned a couple non-obvious shortcuts, like pressing the eject key to switch between the Bluetooth keyboard and the on-screen keyboard, or pressing the spacebar to wake the iPad up when it falls asleep. But what I couldn't find were ways to get back to the home screen or to switch between apps. I was hoping maybe that Command-Tab would cycle between apps in the multitasking tray, but no such luck. So if you or any of your listeners know of a way to switch apps from the Bluetooth keyboard or any other cool tips or tricks for using an external keyboard with the iPad, I would definitely love to hear them. Thanks for all your work with the Maccast.
Hey, thanks for the question, David, because, you know, I had known about some of the features. I knew, as you already mentioned, that several of the special keys, like the brightness keys, F1 and F2 for changing the brightness up and down worked. The media playback keys, skip back, play pause, skip forward. I think that's F7, F8, and F9, respectively. Volume mute, up and down, F10, F11, F12, and the eject button. F13 possibly if you have a different keyboard, but pressing the eject button to bring up the on-screen keyboard, those are all really great. You know, the other thing you can do is any of your text editing and selection commands work. So Command C, Command X, Command V for cut, copy, paste, or copy, cut, paste, I guess I should say. Undo, Command Z for undo, Command Shift Z for redo. Using the Shift plus arrow keys to do text highlighting, highlight sections of text. That all works. You can do all of your keyboard navigation. So Command up arrow to jump to the top of a document, Command down arrow to jump to the bottom of a document, Command left to go to the beginning of a line, Command right arrow to go to the end of a line, Command delete to delete everything on the current line to the left of the cursor, and Option delete to delete the word to the left of the cursor and its preceding space. So all of that editing works. And if you're an old school Emacs person, you'll be happy to know that your Emacs cursor controls also work. Control E will jump you to the end of the line. Control A will go to the beginning of the line. Control K will delete to the end of a line. Control F to move the cursor forward, and Control B to move the cursor backwards. All of those commands will work. Also, a lot of your Option key shortcuts for typing accented characters. those all work because, you know, the international support and the accented character support that's built into OS X. So like some of my favorites, option plus semicolon to do an ellipsis, and option plus E, then typing E to get an accented E, those sorts of accent keys also work as well. But you had specifically asked about accessing the home button, and I would imagine also things like the quick switching bar that you can bring up when you double tap the home button. And I started wondering the same thing. I had never really thought about it before, but it would be really convenient if you could access a lot of more of those kind of keyboard controls and almost control the entire iPad without having to use the touch screen at all. And so I had to do a little digging to figure this out, but I did find kind of a workaround or a way to, not necessarily hack, but get the iPad to have a lot more control from the keyboard. And the key is to use the built-in accessibility options, to use VoiceOver to get some additional options. So I found this great article on how to use VoiceOver to control almost everything on the iPad from the keyboard. It's decadentwaste.net, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But in there, they point out that Apple has, in their user guide, a lot of the information on all of these controls, the different user guides for the devices. And I'll have a link to Apple's manual page as well, and you can check those out for the iPhone, iPad, and iPod Touch. But in essence, what you need to do to get this to work is you have to turn on VoiceOver. And when you turn on VoiceOver, your iPad's going to start speaking to you and everything. And also, it changes some of the ways you have to control the device. So you have to do some extra taps. So you're probably going to want to get familiar with the VoiceOver controls and the differences between using the touchscreen with VoiceOver turned on versus it turned off. I'm not going to go into all those details on this one, but just know that things like selecting an item or tapping on an item, you actually have to double tap. So you have to tap once to select it. It'll get a selection box around it, and then you have to double tap to actually make it activate. That's probably the most general one, but there's a bunch of other differences that you're probably going to have to become familiar with. But to turn on VoiceOver, you go into Settings, General, Accessibility, and you just flip on the VoiceOver toggle, and then it'll immediately start talking to you. And so probably the first thing you're going to want to do if you're just going to want to be using this to control the iPad from the keyboard is to turn off the voice. So if you type Control Option S from your keyboard, that will mute or unmute VoiceOver. Another little trick you can do is you can adjust the speaking rate up so that VoiceOver goes faster. And you can also turn on the Use Compact Voice option. And all of those things will make it so you don't have to listen to VoiceOver quite as long. You can speed it up and get through it talking to you all the time. I just prefer to just mute it when I was playing around with this. But once you have VoiceOver turned on, it opens up all these other keyboard controls. So Control Option H, believe it or not, activates the home button. So you can jump right to your home screen, and tapping it again, of course, goes to the search screen. And you can type Control Option and double tap on H to bring up the background application bar. And then probably the easiest way, once you're in VoiceOver and you're trying to control everything from the keyboard, as I mentioned, you can check the manual and find out what all the keyboard controls are. But as this article points out, the simplest way to control the iPad from the keyboard with VoiceOver is to use what's called the Quick Nav options. And all of these things can be accessed from command option equivalents, but if you press the right and left arrow keys simultaneously, it will toggle on the quick nav mode. And then pressing the up and down arrows simultaneously will simulate a tap once you have an item selected or highlighted. And again, you'll see on the screen when VoiceOver is on, anytime an item is highlighted, it'll have a box around it, a black box around it. And so once that box is around it, if you press the up and down arrows simultaneously, that'll react like you just tapped on it and activate that item. And so In quick nav mode, you can move around by using the arrow keys, right arrow to select the next item, left arrow to select the previous item. If you control up arrow, it'll go to the first item in a list. And if you hit control down arrow, it will go to the last item in a list. If you hold down the option and arrow keys, it will scroll in that direction. So you can jump between items, either up or down, left or right. If you tap the up arrow and left arrow together, it will bring up the rotor and move that to the left. And the rotor is this kind of special control for voiceover. I think we've talked about it before, but it'll allow you to kind of change behaviors within specific applications. Like Safari, it'll change whether you're jumping between form elements when you're doing the navigation or links on a page, something like that. So that's useful if you need to navigate through those applications. And if you press the up arrow and the right arrow together, it'll move the rotor to the right. And you'll see the on-screen feedback to show you what's happening with the rotor. So between VoiceOver being on and this quick nav keyboard commands being activated, you can pretty much navigate and highlight text and work on almost anything that you want on the iPad all from the keyboard. Again, you have to remember that if you've turned off the VoiceOver voice, all of that is happening in the background. And so you may want the ability to quickly toggle VoiceOver on and off. And luckily, you can do that. You can set up the triple click home button option in the VoiceOver settings. So if you go into settings, general accessibility, you'll see there's an option for what happens if you triple click on the home button, and turning on or off VoiceOver is one of those options. So you might want to set that if you plan on doing a lot of heavy work using this trick. But it is kind of a hack around. It's a little bit kludgy, but it worked pretty well. I played with it for a little bit on Saturday and was able to do a surprisingly large number of things all from the keyboard without even touching the touch screen on my iPad. So that's how you do it. Hopefully Apple will enable some more built-in default controls, specifically the ability to activate the home button from the keyboard. But for now, that's how you do it. Unless you buy Apple's special iPad keyboard, which I don't even know if they sell anymore, but I believe that had a home button built right into the keyboard. But beyond that, that's the way you can do it. And I just have one more item that I want to talk to you about today in the MacCast, and then I'll let you go because we're running into one of our supersized episodes. But hey, we had a lot of stuff to cover, lots of stuff going on, and this week's going to be a crazy week. I'll be bringing you new iPad coverage on Friday when I get mine in my hands. I'll give you some perspectives, first looks, and hopefully I'll make it out to an Apple store locally here to do some of the interviews that I like to do on launch day. We'll have to see on that one. But last thing that I wanted to talk to you about today, I talked about all of the stuff that's been going on with Apple and China and worker rights, and I don't like to get political about this stuff. I wherever you fall, whatever side you fall on this issue, I think that's fine. I think the thing I try and drive home is that if it's something that concerns you, if it's something that you want to take a stance on and do something about, then you should do that. But you should also do all of your own research, follow up on things. Don't trust just what you see or hear in the media. Really dig in and make sure that you fully understand what you're fighting for and what you're getting upset about, and that you understand all sides of the equation, and then make an informed decision about what kinds of action you want to take. But then again, I think another thing is so many of us get complacent and we don't follow up on that next step. We don't do that action part. And so I thought it was really great this week when I got an email from a listener who wanted to remain anonymous, but wanted to let us know that he had actually sent a letter to Tim Cook expressing his concerns and support for what Apple was doing over in China in terms of workers' rights. And so I wanted to read you what his letter was and then the response that he got from Apple, because I thought this was a really great example of actually following through and taking action. And so here's what his letter said. It said, "As a longtime and loyal Apple customer, I'd like to encourage you to continue Apple's quest to improve working conditions in its overseas factories. I'm sure it's a very complex issue, but I'd be willing to pay more or wait longer for new products if it meant that factory workers are guaranteed a safe, healthy, and dignified workplace. I think that Apple is in a very unique position to take an industry-wide lead in this, and indeed you are. I've read the materials on Apple.com regarding your supplier policies, and I think that it's really encouraging. However, I know from recent reports in the media that there's more to be done, and I don't want my ownership of a great product to come at the expense of someone else's health and safety. So in conclusion, please make this a top priority at Apple. It's without question the right thing to do. So I thought that was a great letter, first of all, because it's very professional, it's very respectful, it's very straight to the point, and gets, you know, the concerns across, I think, in a very non-confrontational, very open way. It's just saying, hey, I like what you're doing at Apple. I want you to do more. And he actually got a response. It took a little while, but Apple did respond, and this was their response letter. Thank you for writing Apple about working conditions in our worldwide supply chain. At Apple, we believe that every worker has the right to a fair and safe work environment, free of discrimination, and where they can earn competitive wages and they can voice their concerns freely. We work closely with our suppliers to make sure they meet our high standards wherever Apple products are made. Our supplier responsibility program has audited hundreds of factories for compliance with Apple's code of conduct. We encourage you to read about our progress at apple.com/supplier responsibility. Right now, labor rights experts are conducting a series of in-depth, independent inspections of Apple's largest suppliers, including Foxconn. This project was launched at Apple's request and is being coordinated by the Fair Labor Association, a leading nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting worker rights. The FLA will post the results of the investigation on its website, fairlabor.org. If you'd like to learn more about what Apple is doing to protect workers, please click this link to hear Tim Cook's talk about our approach to supplier responsibility at a recent tech conference. And that's the link to the talk that I think he gave at Goldman Sachs, where he talked about this issue. We share your concern for the well-being of workers everywhere. Thanks again for writing. Sincerely, Bill Frederick, Apple. And Bill Frederick is the Vice President of Worldwide Fulfillment and Apple Care at Apple Inc. So, you know, this is a high-level executive. It could be a form letter. It sounds like it possibly is. But the point is that he took action and he got response, and I would assume he's going to continue to follow up and make sure. And I think it's great that Apple is doing this fair labor thing. I'm not saying this is a solution. I'm not saying this is solving any problems, but I think the point is that media attention on stuff these days is sensational. It's instantaneous and it's also fleeting, right? This happened a couple weeks ago, and now everybody's moved on. It's all about the new iPad. It's all about the next great thing. And so while I think it's great that these events happen and it brings everything to the forefront, I think if you're the type of person that's concerned about it, you need to, at that point, then take action, follow up, and do things like this. And so I just thought this was a really great example about how when you care about this stuff, you can continue to take action and do it in a simple but very effective way. And that's why I wanted to share it with you. So, you know, feel free to email, write Apple, talk to them, tell them that you're concerned about this stuff, and keep forcing them to make changes and improve things if that's the cause that you want to take up. And, you know, whatever your cause is, I think that's a great thing. Just always make sure you do it respectfully and in a very professional way, because I think that makes more of an impact and gets through better than some of the more extreme methods. But, you know, people do the extreme methods too. Everybody's got to find their own way, I guess is what it comes down to. I would prefer this method over anything else, but that's it. That's going to do it for today. I know we had a lot to talk about. So if you have feedback for me, please send it along. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Furonix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their products, get more information and details at furonix.com. Circus Ponies, try out Notebook, get free trials, demos, and more information at circusponies.com. Smile, they make text expander, PDF pen, disc label, Text Expander Touch, and now PDF Pen for iPad, which is just awesome. I got to play around with it a little bit more this week. You should really check it out. They have information, demos, trials, everything available on their website at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, get cash for your old iPads, iPhones, iPod Touch. You can do a simple search, get an offer, get more information and details over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. Looking forward to third generation iPad launch day at the end of the week. I'll be bringing you more coverage. If there's anything specific you'd like to hear, any specific questions you have, if you have a feedback or a comment, a review, something you'd like to send me, you can send your emails to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline and leave voicemail. The phone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And that's going to do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.